As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Benvenuto alla Total Soccer Show. Complimenti all'Italia, bastardi. My name is Ryan Bailey. I'm putting pineapple on my pizza and I'm calling it calzone from now on. Joining me today is a man who's proudly wearing his Mrs. Grealish 69 shirt as we speak. It's Taylor Rockwell. Hello.
I mean, I'm kind of frustrated that she beat me to it, that she got to be the first one on global television to rep that one. I thought I was going to unveil it here on the show, but here we are.
I mean, yeah, she totally stole your spot there.
Right?
It was a Man United shirt too, wasn't it? Or am I mistaken?
Oh, I didn't catch that.
It was.
I mean,
yeah.
That and wouldn't be surprising.
I thought it might actually be yours, Taylor.
I'm trying to think of the last name I got on the back of a jersey. It's been a while. It might have been Rooney, and that might have been a gift. But I do love the idea of Mrs. Grealish. I don't know about the number on that one, though.
I just hope she went to the Man United club store and was like, what will it be today, madam? It's going to be Mrs. Grealish and the number 69. Yes, that's right. Please, hurry, please. I've got a game to get to.
I think the only way to do that, especially, is to like act as though you don't know and be like, no, those are the most important numbers. Like, I like defense, but I like attack, so I want the kind of combination of a number 6 with the number 9, and just really try to play it off that way as opposed to just fully owning what was going on there. But I'm glad that we're going this way with it, Ryan. I'm glad that we're finding some levity to this one for you.
This is the only way I can go to stop myself crying. Also here is a man who is dressed today as neither Super Mario nor a pizza. It's our wildling beyond the wall. It's Graham Ruthven.
Hello, Ryan. How are you?
I've had better days, if I'm honest, Graham.
Yeah, I can imagine so. Can you do me... I've got a favour to ask of you, though. Can you let me know when football arrives home? Because you know how annoying it is when you wait in for a package that never arrives, and that is very annoying. So just let me know.
Did you see, by the way, Graham, at the game there was a big Scotland flag behind the goal with Schwarzenegger on it saying, we'll be back?
I did see that.
Yeah, maybe we should get a St. George's flag with the same thing. But we'll be back sooner than you, so, you know, that makes me feel a bit better.
Yeah, you might reach another final in 55 years.
That's not the time, Graham. Also here is a man who's never used a flare inappropriately. It's Joe Lowry.
That picture was a delight to receive on my WhatsApp Ryan, was it you or Graham? I don't remember. It was Graham who sent it, wasn't it?
It was Ryan in the picture, but I sent it.
Of course, yeah. Graham sending a picture of Ryan with a flare, you know, I don't need to go into any more detail here. But also, before we started recording, I want listeners to know, Graham said, you know, I'm not going to go in on Ryan, really. I'm going to, you know, keep it light. That lasted for all of, I don't know, a minute, 2 minutes. It wasn't, I mean, he didn't go in that hard.
He politely asked him to let him know. Like, I totally understand. I know what it's like when your package has been marked delivered and then you check and it's not there. And now there's a question of, did somebody steal it? Like, you want to know for sure. And I think
exactly.
I'm with Graham. He's just asking for confirmation from Ryan whenever that happens.
Just asking for a favor.
Yeah.
Still coming home, Graham. It's just delayed, all right? Anyway, it turns out I went for a run for no reason this morning, by the way. My lucky streak of going for a run and listening to Three Lions twice. every time I go running, or every time England wins, sorry, that streak is now broken. I even thought I had a lucky sort of signal today. I was reaching to get my phone because I wanted to listen to World in Motion. I wanted that John Barnes rap one more time. And just as I went to reach to my pocket, it started playing on a playlist of 1,000 songs. That's a 1 in 1,000 chance for the math fans out there. I thought it was a sign. It wasn't. I'm not in a good place right now. I've got to be honest, guys. This is the first time in my career where I've not really wanted to record a podcast, but I'm glad I am because I'm kind of having my spirits lifted talking to two of you. But I have to say, congratulations to Italy. It's fair and square. They were the better team on the night of the Euro 2020 final, which is what we're here to talk about. England weren't the better team. I'm surprised in many ways that England went this far, but I have to say, I am so proud of this team, not just what it's done on the field, but I've been in England a week now visiting my family, and you can see the way it's brought people together, the way it's given hope to a country that's had a very, very difficult year, and other countries have had a difficult year, of course, but this one has particularly incompetent leadership, and it's just been a very, very difficult time in the UK. And this team was a beacon, and I think they really, really, really did us proud. And Taylor, I'm going to ask you to say something before I start crying right now.
I will say this. I'm with you on the team. And I do think that after the second minute, it seemed like, okay, Gareth Southgate is a genius. I know nothing, which is probably still fair. By the end of it, I think there's some questions to be asked about Gareth Southgate. Though, in trying to figure out like what it would be in my notes, I had it as Southgate goes from genius to, I thought about it for a while, and my conclusion was not genius. Because I still wouldn't even say that he got things like horribly wrong or obvious mistakes were made. But I would say that the team itself, I can get behind. A lot of the things that happened in the lead up to this game did make it hard for me. Obviously, leaning England because of the Daryl Grove connection, because I know his family is home in England watching this game and rooting for England. And there's all those fans who I think are supporters of this show who care about England and were maybe pulling for them. But some of the scenes in the stadium made that very hard for me to get my head around of like, yay, England, who are actively fighting in the stands and in the like the tunnels and such leading to those stands. That made it a little bit difficult. I don't know if that's helped, Ryan, but I will be honest and say that made it slightly odd to watch the game and see that footage coming in at the same time.
Yeah, I fully accept we continually make it hard to be liked. And that is another example of that. Apparently many hundreds, if not thousands of fans in the stadium without tickets. And if you actually watched on the footage, you could see like the aisles at the front were, there were no aisles because they were just full of people who may or may not have been ticket holders. There were supposed to be 60,000 fans at this event. And I couldn't really see a spare seat at Wembley Stadium during play. I think one of the depressing things about this, gents, is it felt so similar to the 2018 World Cup semi-final against Croatia, taking an early lead and then doing very little thereafter and having very little attacking prowess and not looking like getting a winner thereafter. And I'd say this was a little more hopeful than that Croatia game, but it's so sad.
I think it definitely was, and I apologize to Graham and Joe for continuously talking, but to try to make Ryan feel a little bit better, I would say that, like, I don't mean this to be disrespectful to Croatia, but they are not this Italy team who have so much talent, both in their starting 11, coming in as substitutes, even with the injuries they had, there's still so much talent that I really did think this was going to be a 3-0 win for Italy, a pretty comprehensive win at that. And so for England to come out, get that, the go-ahead goal, and then to really flummox Italy for the first 45 minutes. And I saw Italian players yelling at each other and arguing with each other and just sort of being really frustrated really quickly. And we haven't seen that much this whole tournament. And I think that England did a lot of things really well in those opening 45 minutes, less so in the second, and I would say even less so in extra time. But there was a moment there where it did feel like, okay, they have kind of evolved to that next level, and that may well still be the case. But I think this is a much deeper and more talented Italy team than I think other teams that England has had to face recently. So I think you still have to give a little bit of credit to what Southgate did and the decisions he made.
The first 20 minutes in particular, I felt like England had a chance to blow Italy away. Had they scored the second goal, I think it might have been game over. Obviously, in hindsight, it finishes 1-1, so that's a statement of the obvious. But at the time, I feel like a second goal kills that contest entirely. And it felt like we were all very focused, or I certainly was, on when Southgate goes for the you know, the wing backs, the back three with the wing backs, we're all kind of looking at that from the defensive logic of side, but within 2 minutes we see the attacking benefit of that with Trippier crossing for Shaw. And it didn't seem, it felt like Italy were unprepared for that. It felt like they were also unprepared for Harry Kane to drop deep and help out in midfield. We obviously, in the previous podcast, identified the midfield as an area that would essentially determine the whole game. And we spoke about maybe Mount being the one to drop deep, or maybe Henderson even starting as a bit of a curveball. But what it was Kane basically in the first half playing as a midfielder and driving forward. And it felt like Italy were slightly unprepared. Then what obviously happens is Mancini, as I think for me the highest pedigree coach in the whole tournament, maybe along with Luis Enrique, he makes the changes, and then England don't respond to those changes, and I feel that's where the match was lost for England. And even in extra time, England's kind of regained control of the match, and it felt at that point that was the moment for Southgate to go for it. And obviously he puts on Sancho and Sterling, but they're put on for the shootout rather than, I mean, Rashford's playing right back for the last 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And so basically, I think what Southgate forgot was, so the last 16 game against Germany was vindication for Southgate's conservative kind of approach. But what he kind of forgot was that game required him to be bold in throwing on Grealish for the last 20 minutes, who then made the difference after the platform had been established. And it never felt like England really did that in this game. Even after there were moments where they regained control, they never really went for it. And that cost them in the end.
So to reset for any listener who may not have watched the events at Wembley Stadium on Sunday night, this was England against Italy. Italy being the home team in this one. It was 1-1 after extra time. Italy winning 3-2 on penalties. England losing on penalties. Nature is healing everybody. Things are going back to normal. Berardi missing the first penalty, and then Sancho and Rashford missing. Jorginho, of all people, missing the fifth penalty. When he didn't get a red card, it felt like he was going to be the guy to win it, but he did not. It was poor Bukayo Saka, 19 years old, tasked with the task of taking England's fifth penalty, and ultimately that didn't come to pass. Joe, let's get back to the setups, the lineups here, and the formations. When we previewed this final, I don't think any of us predicted it would be a back three. I think we were all fairly confident it would be a back four, and that's what it started off with, and Kieran Trippier coming in for Saka into the lineup. What did you make of that?
Yeah, I thought it would be a back four just because that's what Gareth Southgate had been doing in the build up to this game. And the shift to the back three is not a shock, right? That's the system that they entered, or that's a system that they've used a lot in this tournament as well. I think England are almost equally comfortable in both, and it doesn't drastically change how they play. I will say though, I think the 3-4-3, which is essentially what it looked like in possession, I think it worked out really well, especially as Graham highlighted in the first 20 minutes of this game, and even I'll extend that to the majority of the first half. So often it was Harry Kane dropping in and adding an extra number into midfield. It was Raheem Sterling who played as that right-sided winger tucked inside with Trippier able to overlap. Raheem Sterling would be able to drop in and get on the ball a little bit and then drive the ball forward. I think England's ball movement in the first half looked better than almost any point I've seen in this tournament. They were moving the ball with purpose. They were finding space. They were attacking. And I think the 3-4-3 helped them create those numerical advantages in central midfield with Declan Rice and Calvin Phillips as the double pivot. And then you've got Mason Mount and Raheem Sterling as the two tens or the two narrow wingers. And then Kane, almost five guys, not all of them in that space at the same time, but having that natural numerical advantage over Italy's three central midfielders gave England almost constant outlets, and Italy just could not figure out how to apply pressure on the ball in that first half. Obviously, England get the opening goal. They still keep attacking, which I think is impressive. And then in the second half, it all fades a little bit because England take their foot off the gas, which, to be fair, I don't think is the worst idea in the world. It's Italy here. You need to compress space. You need to manage the game. But England in the second half, I thought, really struggled to find the balance between effective defending, which they kind of pushed all their chips into that little bucket, and then actually effective transition attacking. They really struggled to get forward. They concede the goal off of the corner kick for Italy, and then they still can't really get forward in regulation, which limits their ability to actually win the game at all in the first 90 minutes, and then it's on to hoping in extra time, and obviously that didn't pay off.
It did not. Graham, when I saw the back three decision, I thought this was a more of a conservative move. But as Joe has kind of laid out there, and Gareth Southgate said on the TV, it was an attacking move. The quote from Southgate, Italy calls you a tactical problem. They have a familiar way of playing, and it's a problem which is difficult to resolve with a winger because he ends up defending in our own third of the pitch. We want to keep our attacking players higher up the pitch, which we hope will cause them a problem higher up. And as Joe says, the opening stages, when it could have been a couple of goals to the good, it was a successful tactic.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the first 20 minutes or so, even in the first half, the English right side were having a field day, had all the space in the world. And that was causing Italy so many problems. Obviously, that's where the cross for the first goal comes from, but there was a couple other good opportunities down that side. And one of the things, I think it was Karol Anka on Twitter, he highlighted how one of the changes, the subtle changes that Italy made that really worked for them, and once he highlighted this, I kept my eye on it, and he was spot on, was that Verratti basically took it upon himself, or it might have been an instruction from Mancini, I guess, but he took it upon himself to disrupt that link between Walker and Trippier on the right side.
Yeah.
And so what that did was that pulled Mason Mount over to Verratti to try and combat him getting involved there, and that then created space on the right for Di Lorenzo, who in the first half of the first half, if you follow me, was a non-entity at all. But then as the game went on, I think he actually has more crosses than anyone else over the full match, 4 crosses completed for Italy. So he was kind of ghosting into space on that right side, and that was just one of the smart little changes that Mancini made and Italy made over the course of the match, with Cristante coming on as well in the second half. He seemed to be pushing high on Phillips in particular, which was a big part of the reason why England were struggling to play through Italy in that second half. I thought that second half was really bad for England. I thought they were quite lucky to get to 90 minutes level and get extra time, to be honest, because it really felt like they got things quite badly wrong in that second half, or rather, Italy got a lot of things right, and Cristante was another one of those things. So it was definitely an interesting tactical tussle. I enjoyed watching the changes that happened. And I think the biggest difference in this game, even though it is decided by a penalty shootout, of course, so not much between the two teams, but I think Mancini showed that he was Italy's biggest asset in this tournament, and it was his kind of changes that won it for them.
Well, more on those changes, and maybe we'll touch on the poophousery that Italy displayed in the latter stages of this game after this break.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Total Soccer Show, we have returned. We're talking about the Euro 2020 final, which doesn't matter who won. Let's get talking about it anyway. Taylor, I'll come to you. Talk about England for a little bit longer. Kieran Trippier, did he have his invisibility shield on for the first 20 minutes or so? Because it seemed like he was left unmarked by the Italian backline for a lot of periods of time. And anything else you noticed that England were doing?
Well, first off, I was surprised to see him in the starting 11. I also thought it would be a back four for England. My friends of mine were maybe wiser than I. They bet on Kieran Trippier to not only start, but to get an assist. So they were very, very happy when he did both of those things. So credit to them for that one. But I do think a big reason why he was so open is because Gareth Southgate not only went for that back three slash back five as the game went on, but also let Kyle Walker get involved in the attack a little bit more in those opening 15 or 20 minutes. And that's the thing when we were doing our teams of the tournament, I had Kyle Walker as my right wing back starting, but with the caveat that like he hasn't really done much attacking in the, in this tournament. And yet he does make that overlapping run. And that's a big reason why I think Italy aren't as inclined to put pressure on Trippier, because they're not quite sure if that ball is going wide to Kyle Walker. And so they stand off. And I think that's where that space comes from. And there were those sort of unexpected runs, those unexpected overlaps or overloads that really did make Mancini blink, I think, and he had to adjust. And that's where I go with Graham, that I think some of the adjustments he made were just so incredibly smart. We already talked about the Verratti one, but clearly England had spotlighted that Lorenzo Insigne is the threat, or one of the main threats for Italy. And again, to give credit to Karl Anka, I think he pointed out that Kyle Walker and Kieran Trippier were constantly observing what Insigne was doing, tracking him, making sure he was never open. And Mancini, as soon as that starts to become very clear that they're just going to man mark him and not let him get any time and space, makes a really smart instruction, which is that he really encourages Emerson to get forward, but be smarter in possession. Emerson in the first 15-20, he's involved in the attack, but has a heavy touch and loses the ball, has another heavy touch and concedes a foul, has another one where I think he dribbles out of bounds. And there seems to be a priority on getting him further forward, not necessarily to be involved in the attack, but to pin England back a bit more. And then Insigne starts cutting inside, which is no new thing, except now he starts doing it 30 and 40 yards from the England goal, which means England's defense now has to make a choice. Does somebody track him and step to him, or do we keep our shape? Which means he's going to be open in the midfield, and now there is an overload, because with Kane dropping in, I think the numbers were more balanced. But once Insigne is in there, you do have a mismatch there. England, when they make that adjustment, I think then Italy kept making smart little changes. And I think that was the story of the game for me, is that Mancini was able to make smart adjustments, smart substitutions, and keep his foot on the gas once they had it on there, until about the 113th minute, when it feels like England or Italy were more okay with penalties slash maybe getting one on the counter, but definitely not conceding in extra time.
Joe, if Mancini made smart little decisions, did Southgate make unsmart little decisions throughout this game? Because, was a very strong start, and we saw the Trippier in that higher position than Shaw on the other side, lots of energy, and then sort of the game, there was a lot of, giving the ball away cheaply and a lot of stuff and not creating enough chances, and we can put that on the players, but what do you think maybe Southgate did wrong as the game progressed?
It's so easy, and I want to lead with this. It's so easy for me to talk about what should have happened or what would have benefited England. It's a lot harder to be the person making those decisions and to try to actually transmit those decisions from your spot on the sideline to the field where there are thousands and thousands and thousands of fans yelling and making noise and all that stuff. It's hard. I'm not saying that this is an easy thing for Gareth Southgate, but the biggest issue for me is something I mentioned already. It's England's inability to balance defensive work and defending deep in their own half in the second half with actually getting forward and attacking in that second 45. England had exactly one shot from open play in this game, and it came in the second minute, and it came from Luke Shaw, and it came on that goal. No more shots in open play from England in this entire game. You can't really expect to win that way. And in a sense, that's been England all along, right? They come out strong, they start well, they score, they create some chances early on, then they pack things in either with the ball, or in this game, it happened to be more without the ball. But this is a little bit of the downside, and the margins are so small, but this is a little bit of the downside, is when you're not really set up and to attack and to go forward, and when you've chosen to draw your line of confrontation pretty deep in your own half, it makes it really difficult to go after you've conceded and go get that game winner, or go get that at least go ahead goal and force Italy back a little bit more. There were some changes that Southgate tried to make, right? They stepped up a little bit further forward and tried to press a little bit higher when Saka comes on for Trippier in the second half, and they switched to that 4-4-2 or a 4-5-1 more often defensively. But still, they got pinned back a lot. They struggled to find the moments to get forward. That, for me, was the real killer. Because in extra time, I thought it was a lot more even. And not that England looked particularly dangerous with the ball, but they clearly had decided, okay, we need to play a little bit more. We have the talent to do this. Jack Grealish comes on in the first extra time period, and they are pushing for it a little bit more. But part of me thinks it was just a little too late at that point.
Graham, a couple of questions for you about the substitutions that Southgate made. For the second game running, we had a player coming on and coming off again. It was Jordan Henderson this time. Came on in the 74th minute for Declan Rice, presumably to advance things forward a little bit more. And then coming off again. So like, get your thoughts on what happened there. And also Jack Grealish coming on in extra time. A nation clamouring for him every second of this game, and indeed this tournament, to the extent that it gets a bit annoying how much people are clamouring for him. But he, I mean, what did you make of his introduction? Could it have been sooner?
Oh yeah, definitely could have been sooner for me. And I draw that analogy to the round of 16 win over Germany, where that was really a game of vindication for Southgate, but it still required him to be bold in putting Grealish on. And so the fact he comes on, what is it, 10 minutes into extra time?
Yeah.
The 99th minute, felt way too late for me. Then I do understand why he was reluctant maybe to put on another attacker in that, or another creative player in that Italy were doing such a good job of stopping the supply line. So as I mentioned, Cristante seemed to be very high on Phillips, and that fragmented the Phillips-Rice relationship, which at points of this match had been really effective. And then I think maybe that's why Jordan Henderson comes off, is maybe just to provide a little bit more dynamism, slightly higher up the pitch than Declan Rice offers. But then if you put on Grealish, and then you end up with another player isolated slightly higher up the pitch, then that obviously just increases the pressure on Calvin Phillips. But actually what I think it did do was just drop the Italian midfield slightly deeper to kind of handle Grealish. And so that actually opened up more space for Calvin Phillips. So I could see which it going either of those two ways. And actually it did seem to work out for England. As I say, I said earlier, the extra time period, I thought they were, particularly the second half of extra time, which I guess is when Grealish was on the pitch for most of that extra time, I thought they regained control of the match. So yeah, certainly Southgate, for me, should have put on Grealish a lot earlier. And then the changes late in extra time, I tweeted this out, they were both too late and too early in terms of putting Rashford and Sancho on. So you obviously would want them on the pitch to actually have an impact on the game. They were put on for the shootout, I think it's pretty fair to say. Ironic then that both players then missed those penalties. And there was a period in the shootout when every player who was doing a stutter run-up was missing. I just wouldn't do a stutter run-up. That's probably quite a proper football man opinion, but just run up and slam it. Harry Maguire, that's how I would take a penalty, but instead of mine going in the top corner, it would just go into row Z. but yeah, so what I mean by they were too early was England had 3 minutes of kind of holding on for a shootout with Rashford at right back. And I don't even know where Sancho was playing, to be honest. They didn't really have a system for those last 3 minutes when Italy had the ball almost exclusively. So yeah, it was quite impressive that Southgate managed that both too early and too late. But I thought he got his subs wrong, and I also thought he got the shootout penalty takers wrong as well. It doesn't sit well with me that a 19-year-old is taking the... It doesn't matter how good he is or how much conviction he has in himself, and obviously Southgate trusts him, and that's important, but I just wonder where Sterling and Grealish are at that point, and I think maybe that is on the manager at that time to kind of recognise that a 19-year-old shouldn't be taking that penalty.
Graham, in those final moments with those final substitutions, I did sort of get excited because it seemed like Sancho and Rashford were ready to go. There's a throw-in for Italy, we wait a second, and then they're not ready, they have to change something, and so the throw-in is taken. And at that moment, I wondered, like, how impressive would it have been from Italy to just keep possession until the final whistle went, to just not let those substitutions happen? I kind of would have respected it, even if it probably would have led to, like, an overly aggressive tackle from an England player to make sure those subs occurred.
Yeah, well, in the end, it was in Italy's benefit, you know, in their best interest for those two players to come on.
But that would have been a level of gamesmanship that I wouldn't have been surprised to see from Italy. Because the other, I think, kind of big narrative for me in regulation and in extra time was Italy having like calm and discipline in their performance when it was necessary, and England having the opposite of that. And I would point to little things like there's the Chiellini yellow on Saka, which is a very obvious yellow. He pulls him back, he throws him down. I forget who was making this point on Twitter, but I would agree with it, which is that like you have to have, it was David Amoyal was saying that you have to have the immediacy of the awareness of knowing what the threat is, and you've got to be, if you're Chiellini, recognize that and make that foul right there. Because if you let a couple yards go, you're probably not catching Saka there. And if you do, then it's a more clear-cut chance and maybe it's more of an argument for a red card. And I think how quickly Italy were able to read situations and adapt to them was important. But then for Chiellini to make an overlapping run in the 122nd minute, or for Bonucci, there's one in extra time when it's a long ball. He has, I think it's Sterling, running at him at full speed, and he goes for just the very clever little flick from the back of his head all the way back to Donnarumma. And if he mishits that, if he doesn't take it perfectly the way he does, it's a chance for Sterling to run onto, or Donnarumma has to make sort of an improvised play. And just that calm in the back had to give Italy a bit more confidence. And I contrast it with at the very end of the first period of extra time, England draw a free kick. They're in a dangerous position. They get everybody set, and then the free kick is taken, and immediately the whistle is blown for two different fouls by England players trying to get into attacking positions. And in that moment, we're into injury time of that extra time period. Like, there's no chance Italy are going to counterattack and score. That would have been a moment for England to get their wits about them and threaten. And that's where their goal came from, was off a cross. Why not try that again? Why not sort of back yourselves to make a play? And that they just immediately foul, to me, said there isn't that, like, mental discipline that maybe Italy had in the necessary moments.
If we were to talk about Italy's gamesmanship, let's come back to that Chiellini incident with Saka, the horse collaring. this is another example of Ryan doesn't know the rules of soccer, but how close is that to a professional foul? Anybody know? It feels stronger than a yellow to me. I don't know.
I think in one of the 101s I did about like soccer terminology, I said that I think like you can use professional foul for a lot of different things, but when you hear a British commentator say it was a cynical foul, that's when you know it was a professional foul that maybe crossed the line. And that's what I would say that foul was from Chiellini. It was cynical in that he knew exactly what was happening, exactly what needed to be done, and had made a mistake to put himself in that position. So rather than just sort of like pull back the jersey a little bit and it's a yellow card and it's a professional foul, that was a cynical one, because he does indeed go for the horse collar.
And what about Jorginho's stamp on Mrs. Grealish 69's future husband? He sort of got to the ball, but then put his studs on Grealish's upper thigh. Any thoughts on whether that? It feels like one that could have been given a red, yeah. And maybe you got away with that, Graham.
Yeah, and Mrs. Grealish 69 was very nearly very disappointed with where that tackle took place on Grealish. But yeah, it definitely felt like a red to me. I thought that was, and the way it went to VAR as well, I was quite convinced it was going to be a red. The only thing I can maybe think of is the contact with even though his studs are kind of up, the contact with Grealish, obviously his leg is like flat on the floor. So actually the contact doesn't really happen that high up. But it still felt like a bit of a stamp challenge for me. So yeah, this was a red card for me.
Once Jorginho did that, it felt absolutely written in the stars that he would take and win the game with the fifth penalty. Just it felt like that had to happen. And that didn't quite happen in the narrative, but I'm kind of glad that didn't in a way. Joe, before we go to another quick break, can you give me something to smile about before we go away for a minute? Just any positive England performances you saw. I thought Declan Rice was superb. This is probably one of his better, if not his best, England game here. By far the best performance Rashford's ever given at right back as well, I'd say. anything else?
I mean, we've already talked about Harry Kane, who I thought was just superb. I know, Ryan, you don't love to hate Harry Kane, but I know there's not a ton of love there for you. So I'll pick somebody else. I really do think Luke Shaw was excellent in this game, not just because he scores that opening goal, but just, I don't know, the way he operates on that left side, his left foot is so clean. And he wasn't really...
How well does
really...
he take that shot, by
yeah,
the way?
I mean, the shot is unreal. The aerial camera angle as well that they show on the broadcast after the initial angle, it's beautiful. The way Luke Shaw just gets forward and has the ability to impact games, and it's a shame because he didn't really have a huge chance to after the first 45, but just a really impressive player that I'm more and more impressed with every time I watch him for England, and for Taylor's sake, I hope I feel the same way this season with Man United.
If I had the time and inclination, I would have cut that Luke Shaw goal in with the footage of Mourinho from All or Nothing when he turns the TV off and sort of throws the remote down. that should have been... That, I hope somebody did that out there somewhere. We're going to have more on this game. We'll talk about the penalty shootout and a little bit more as well after this short commercial break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach. but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more. This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, we have returned. We are talking about the Euro 2020 final. Italy coming out victors. England came out victors in my hopes and dreams. It was Italy who got 3-2 win on penalties in this one. How about that shootout, gents? Quite a lot of missed penalties here, the majority obviously going England's way. Taylor, tell me this. What was the biggest surprise? The manner in which Harry Maguire scored the perfect penalty, which went at 300 miles an hour, or Jorginho missing a penalty? I did not see either of those things happening.
The Harry Kane, the way he took it, like how confidently he took it, and the fact that I believe I'm correct in saying that even though it doesn't statistically count, that was his first touch in the Italy box. That also may be a little bit surprising that in that moment he is as confident as he is. And it seemed like that was going to get England off to the start they needed. Harry Maguire then finishing his the way he did. It was shades of one of my favorite penalties of all time, Owen Hargreaves scoring for Manchester United against Chelsea in the Champions League. Just how emphatic it was in a moment that it needed to be, because Belotti had just missed his. So for Maguire to step up, and it seemed like, unless he can score it with his head, I don't know how this is going to work. And then he buries it top corner. Things seemed to be going well for England at that point.
Yeah, and the whole thing about bringing in players specifically for penalty shootouts, Graham, I mean, I can think of a certain goalkeeper, being brought in by the Netherlands in a World Cup, and that working out pretty well. But in practice, it doesn't seem to always work out that well, and it didn't work out well here, as you say, with Rashford and Sancho both missing and them both coming on in the 120th minute. That seems problematic for Gareth Southgate, whose copybook is pretty much unblemished up to this point. Up to the point of this game, I should say. And then having, as you say, a 19-year-old Saka taking the fifth penalty. And what I wonder in situations like this is, like, where's players like Raheem Sterling in the lineup? Why has this order taken place like this? I'm confused.
It was a bit confusing. I don't like, so there's two things that I've already mentioned. I don't like the, you know, 19-year-old taking a penalty before more experienced members of the squad. And then obviously Southgate has maybe seen him, you know, maybe Saka has been smashing them in training. And but I still don't really like it when there's so much pressure on a sudden death penalty like that. The other thing is I don't like putting on outfield players for penalties. I think it can work with goalkeepers because obviously the dynamic with a goalkeeper is slightly different. So, you know, they don't really get held accountable if they don't make the saves. So it really only feels like the mind games can work in your favour. So with obviously you're referencing Tim Krul there at the 2014 World Cup.
That's right.
I would say. So yeah, I can see that working, but with outfield players, you know, a penalty in a shootout is already a high pressure environment. And so when you're putting on players who have been put on specifically for a shootout, it just raises the pressure that little bit more. And I knew that Rashford was missing his as soon as he's doing the stutter and Donnarumma just stands and stares him down and doesn't really move. And obviously in the end, I think maybe Donnarumma actually dives the wrong way on Rashford's penalty. But obviously Rashford has been distracted slightly and is obviously going for a little bit too much of the corner, hits the post. I knew that was going to happen with Rashford. So yeah, some strange decisions in the shootout for me.
Graham, did you think your feed had frozen for a minute? Because that was a blue and Rashford stood there for like a good 5 seconds.
So there was a thing a number of players were doing. A couple of the Italian players did that. And I wondered if the feed was sending through the referee's whistle early or something. But it was a little bit peculiar. I'm with you on that.
Yeah, there were some far too long a dramatic pauses. I completely agree. We were sitting there going, come on, you're going to take it yet? But with the Rashford penalty, he did the Jorginho thing in a way of watching the keeper and not looking at the ball. You know, many other players, Eden Hazard does it as well, doesn't he? And so the two players who did it in this shootout, Jorginho and Rashford, failed. So and Harry Maguire hitting it Alan Shearer style succeeded. So I think, Taylor, we can say that 90s soccer wins here and modern stuff is rubbish, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I continue to say pick a side and hit it to that side. I think there is, if you have the poise and confidence and self-belief to back yourself in the run-up to kind of make that decision, then I think credit to you, but I don't. And I think if you're running up and thinking, is it that way? Is it this way? Is it that way? Weirdly, the comparison I always go to, and I did not do this. I would assume that Graham and Ryan didn't either, but it's like the old saying about if you're walking down the aisle for your wedding thinking like, worst case scenario, it's a divorce. Like, that's not the way you want to go into weddings. And I think here, if you're starting that run up thinking like, what's he going to do? Is he going that way? Let me see. Like, if you're reacting to the goalkeeper, in my mind, you've sort of already lost because you're not just sort of backing yourself to score. And it's maybe it's the hop, maybe it's the stutter step, but I think of Harry Kane, you have to believe, just picked his spot and hit the ball. Harry Maguire, I think, picked his spot and hit the ball. And I think a couple other Italian players did that as well. And then you do have those moments of maybe overthinking. I think the Italy takes were especially interesting when you contrast them with what they did against Spain. We can talk about that now or later. I leave it to you, Ryan. But I think this penalty shootout was pretty fascinating from beginning to end.
I do want to add just in support of, I mean, I don't really care one way or the other in terms of penalty approach. I don't know which is better statistically. I'd kind of let that be the decider for me. But I will say Bonucci did the hop as well, and he did score his penalty. So who knows? Maybe there is something to it.
Bonucci, by the way, I believe the oldest player to score in a European Championship final, and we had the earliest goal in the European Championship final in here. So plenty of records being broken in this one. Oh boy! I mean, what else do we say about this game? Taylor, any more thoughts on this one?
Yeah. I think the shootout itself was pretty interesting because we start with Berardi. He didn't take one versus Spain, but he did send it to the almost exact same spot as Locatelli, who was the opener for Italy in that game. After that, it's the same takers in the same order. And it's Belotti missing by going the opposite way he did against Spain. And I think there we have to pause and give credit to Jordan Pickford, because Pickford essentially stands to Pickford's right, which is where Belotti put the ball against Spain, and invites him to aim at the much more open left side and then dives to that side and makes that save. And from there, I believe I'm correct in saying that every Italian shooter put it to the opposite side that they did against Spain, or put it like mostly to the opposite side. I think it's Bernardeschi goes right down the middle. He had gone to one side against Spain, and even Bonucci, when he goes to the opposite side, he also puts it high. And Pickford goes to the exact right spot, reads that one, but just has his hands low and then has to try to get one hand up to make that save. If Bonucci had hit that maybe a foot lower or 8 inches lower, I think that one gets saved. So Pickford definitely did his homework and backed himself. And I think Italy, for their part, did the same. And it ended up just being that England's takers couldn't get the job done. And to Graham's point, I think Italy's takers were 26, 27, 34, 27, and 29. England's takers were 27, 28, 23, 21, and 19. So maybe there is that argument for you want the veterans who back themselves, who are calm in that moment, versus the youngsters who've grown up hearing England don't win penalties, England can't win in shootouts, England can't win in major tournaments, and all that pressure is on them. And maybe that pressure comes to bear in that critical moment.
Taylor, when you make salient points on penalty shootouts, I just think, and obviously referring to your world famous penalty diagrams, I just think of the guy from Arrested Development who George Bluth Sr. hired to teach the kids lessons. And he just comes in and he says, and that's why you do a penalty diagram for every game.
I'm not going to lie, Ryan, you broke up for everything but the very end when I heard, and that's why you do a penalty diagram. And I'm going to assume that that was a reference to J. Walter Weatherman from Arrested Development, in which case I agree with you. That is why you diagram these things, so you know in advance. Jordan Pickford had the duct tape notes on his water bottle. I'm assuming he knew these things too, and maybe that's why he went the way he did.
Taylor, Graham, I think we've lost Ryan to the depths of the internet, maybe while he's also drowning himself in his own tears. But I will say, just to pick us up.
Just a solid burn on the end, Joe, while he's not there to defend himself. Good work, buddy. Good work.
Thank you. I'm trying to learn from Graham. That's really all this is for me. That's all this whole tournament's been for me. I do want to say, just as I know we're nearing the end of our episode here, I think there are real big picture positives here for England, and I want to talk about those momentarily. But first, I just want to say Italy. What a team, right? The three of us did, Graham, Taylor, you and I, the three of us did that show, the first show of this tournament, Italy versus Turkey. And I don't think we realized at the time how good Italy were. And it's become very clear throughout the course of this tournament that they are a force to be reckoned with. And they 100% deserve this victory. And I'm, as a neutral in this game, I am happy that they got that victory because this was such a phenomenal team and a team that I believe, Graham, you said plays at the international level, kind of like they're at the club level. And that's not an easy thing to do. So that's my kind of big picture positive for Italy. Well done to them and to Roberto Mancini. And then for England, this team has so much talent. And they were one or two penalty kicks away from winning this whole thing. The margins are so fine. Losing hurts and it stings, and losing this way hurts and stings all the more. But I don't really have much doubt that this team's going to be back in November or December or whenever on earth that World Cup is going to be in 2022. This is a really good team. I do think Gareth Southgate did a fairly good job at this tournament. Yes, there are little things we can pick out and complain about, the penalty kick shootout being one of them. But man, I don't really doubt that England are going to be a force to be reckoned with at the international level in 2022 and beyond.
Yeah, they will be back, unfortunately.
Well, do we think there will be a sort of lasting scar from this one? Like, my assumption would be Southgate will still be in charge. They've got World Cup qualifying. Then we'll have the World Cup. Like, do we think that it could be potentially too much pressure? Or do we feel like, once again, we kind of have experience, they're building towards the right thing, and maybe they come back with the idea that maybe next time if you go 1-0 up instead of sitting back, just go for like 2-3 and then win it in comfortable style?
I think there was enough in the way that they played at this tournament to suggest that Southgate learned a lot of lessons from the 2018 World Cup, and so you would assume that he would learn lessons from what went wrong in this tournament and apply those lessons to the World Cup next year. But one thing I would say is, do you remember how much was made of the heat for that first game England played against Croatia? Oh, yes. Good luck in Qatar, guys.
But don't worry, because they're going to have climate-controlled stadiums, and they're going to be underground, sure. And it won't be, oh, wait, no, never mind, none of that happened. It's going to be the winter, though, so hopefully that's fine. We'll have plenty more of criticizing Qatar to do as we go forward, but we should probably just say congratulations once again to Italy. I do think I didn't really have them on my list of favorites heading into the tournament, but I will say after, I went back to my notes after that first game I had, Italy might win this, question mark? And yeah, I stand by that one. I think they might end up winning this one, is going to be my final note on this tournament. I am sad Ryan is not with us, though I think he might be listening. I'm not entirely sure. But I would just say I would like to take a moment to just acknowledge that, like, Daryl and I have done these tournaments since 2014. We've covered the World Cups. We've covered the Euros. And they are really demanding, and they're really difficult to do. And I was very nervous heading into this one because without Daryl, I've never covered a tournament like this before. And you all really did an amazing job of stepping up and covering every game. And there were never the concerns about, like, are you guys actually watching? Are they kind of going through the motions? And it's not easy, especially with Graham having to cover things in different sports at the same time. And I just think you all did such a great job. I'm sad Ryan isn't here with us, but I'm sure he'll hear this as well. But I just wanted to take a moment to say, just job done. Credit to all of you for hard work in this tournament. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you're not completely burnt out, and we'll be willing to talk about soccer or football, Graham, as we go forward this season, because there's a lot more to get to.
Yeah, I mean, thank you, Taylor, for sure. Thank you for letting us come on and make this happen. It has been a blast, and maybe it'd be even blastier without one of those extra time games somewhere in this tournament. But this was fun, man. This was fun.
Yeah, I was going to say as well, it's genuinely been a lot of fun, and I hope that comes across in you know, the podcasts we've recorded. And for it to end with an England defeat in a penalty shootout, and the Englishman in this team, not just not being able to gloat, but not even being on the podcast for the final few minutes. Wow.
Yeah,
I really
right?
want it of this one.
I mean, I think we should note that, like, even with England's penalty misses in this one, at least all their players, like, stuck around till the end, whereas our illustrious Englishman has just fled when we were getting near the end of regulation, when it seemed like penalties might be looming. That's when Ryan Bailey said goodbye. So credit to Saka, Sancho, Rashford, Maguire, and Harry Kane for sticking around to take theirs. Condemnation to Ryan Bailey for not doing the same. But on that sad note for Ryan, I will just say one more time, Graham Ruthven, thank you very much for talking about all of these many, many Euro games with myself and the rest of the crew.
That is no problem, Taylor. It is always fun, and well done to you as well on this. We should say that too.
Oh, thank you. And Joe Lowry, the same to you. Credit to you. Well done, my friend.
Thank you, Taylor.
Listeners, well done to you all for listening to everything, to watching all the games. But we will continue to discuss soccer as the summer goes forward, including the USA's game, which kicks off in theoretically like an hour and a half or so. We'll see if that ends up being the case. But Joe and I are going to be reviewing that one. We're going to be doing all the US's Gold Cup games and maybe a few other ones. We'll be doing some transfer catch up this week, the four of us, and many, many more shows to come from this summer of soccer, including with the US women's national team in the Olympics. But for now, thank you all again so much for listening, and we will talk to you all again very soon.